This is Dave Blogtoven Bowers.
And this is Ryan Denardis.
And you're listening to
Perennial Dissonance. Today we're going to be talking about counterpoint, which is regarded as one of those rigorous studies that you need to know if you're going to do anything really deep and important in music. It's kind of this culturally accepted requirement. And there's often, although not a whole lot of it, there's still quite a bit of spoken frustration with the fact that it's still so present, especially what kind of counterpoint we deal with. So generally, when we talk about counterpoint, we're going to be covering not just the typical counterpoint, but all forms of counterpoint. Usually we're talking about 18th century counterpoint, specifically that which was employed by Bach. However, we should probably find a decent definition of what counterpoint is before we jump into it. Counterpoint is essentially the linear note relations, linear note relations, specifically harmonically and vertically. When we talk about counterpoint, we're typically talking about the horizontal and vertical relationships between notes, such that harmonies align without becoming too dissonant in ways which would be, unpleasant, I suppose.
Unpleasant according to certain folk.
Well, there's plenty of treatises written on counterpoint, and the people we normally look to, there's Guillaume de Machaut, there's Josquin du Prez, there's Fuchs.
I always think of Rameau, but I don't know if Rameau. That was counterpoint specifically, or if that was more harmony related. I think it was treatise on harmony, so I don't know if it really...
Well, counterpoint is an important part in harmony.
That is true.
Too,
and counterpoint is how you get good harmony,
mm-hmm.
or in how you move in and out of any scenario, but in and out of good harmony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a good definition. At least a good working definition. So typically when you learn counterpoint, as I said, you learn this kind of 18th century approach that was... Well, we consider it was mastered by Bach. So you'll typically pull out his chorales, and you'll be studying the harmonic structures of his chorales, and then the way he implemented them through his fugues and his inventions.
Inventions, yeah, and how the voice leads, and basically just...
How he approaches dissonant intervals, how he approaches key changes, too. It's very significant.
And there's various species... Mm-hmm. That you learn, and they increase in, I guess, difficulty.
Right. Well, you have five different species. First species is whole note against whole note. Second is half note against whole note. Third is quarter note against whole note. Fourth is, I think I'm kind of bastardizing the concept a little bit, but the point is that they get smaller, and then the fifth species is free counterpoint, where you'd use mixtures of the other four. It's specific rules about how you can approach different notes, how to craft contour out of your compositional lines while allowing for a natural, pleasant harmony to come out. The problem with this, the reason it's often criticized, or at least one of the reasons it's often criticized, is that it's often used to support an old view of what tonality should be. And this is kind of difficult. I mean, we're talking about a harmony that is rooted in the 18th century thoughts of dissonance and consonance, which today is, you know, we generally don't consider it that way, or at least not in the academic or experimental worlds. Although there are those people who still write like it's 1874. But yeah, so I mean, this is the basis of counterpoint. And most people who study composition and theory, they have to go through this process. They have to study it really closely and pass a test in it. I believe even in Italy for a time, it still might be that way now. Many of the universities that taught universities and conservatories that teach composition require you to write a double fugue for orchestra before you can graduate and get your PhD. So counterpoint is still considered very seriously in a lot of musical spheres of practice. But, I mean, that's a very rigorously strict definition of counterpoint. And, in fact, considering what definition we have, the relationships between notes, the way they execute, the way they move in and out of harmonies, this actually refers to a whole lot of different things. There was a quote with Beethoven, a critic actually approached him and accused him of breaking the parallel fifths rules in one of his symphonies. And he said, "So whose rules are they?" And they said, "Well, they're the rules of counterpoint as established by Rameau and Fuchs." And he said, "No. Yes, they established them. I'm breaking them. I use my own counterpoint. None of that matters."
I think even the various composers who wrote on counterpoint knew that these were rules which were meant to be broken. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes no sense to say that there is a regiment set of laws that must be followed. I mean, then you would never advance.
Well, even Bach would actually build up to the break. He'd actually kind of craft his piece in such a way so that when he broke the rules of counterpoint, it was for a very specific purpose, whether it be something referring to the climax of the composition or something that is extremely expressive toward the end. He had that crafted in mind. He knew when he was going to break it. Nowadays, you have composers who consciously break those traditional rules because they have an idea of how breaking those rules can create new aesthetic goals. You also have a lot of composers who don't care about preserving traditional counterpoint at all. And it's obviously not at any loss to them.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting because with Renaissance music and before Renaissance music, music was set up in a completely different way. I mean, you had parallel octaves, you had parallel fifths.
It was actually enforced.
It was enforced, yeah. And you, the interval of focus was the perfect fourth. Mm-hmm. And since the Renaissance, perfect fourths are hated. You don't want to have perfect fourth movement and perfect fourths.
You don't even want the perfect fourth at all.
Yeah.
Because it's a very weak interval.
Yeah.
With the chords. That's what we call that's the second inversion. The 6-4. It makes a chord that sounds like it needs to go somewhere, that it's not stable at all. So when you have parallel fourths, it's obviously very weak and almost transparent motion.
Of course, then Debussy brings perfect fourth movement.
And it sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing. But that's Debussy. He's unique. But, I mean, there are a lot of composers who have formed their own rules of counterpoint. There's even been composers who have implemented dissonant counterpoint, where you essentially do all the things you shouldn't do in counterpoint and avoid all the things you should do. So you end up with pieces that sound actually completely different, but kind of the same, ironically. There's actually this concept of counterpoint in a lot of audio recording today that's a major contention. It's not quite the same approach to counterpoint, because obviously with composition, we still mostly sort of deal with the whole notational thing. You still have these dots and lines to worry about. When you're recording, you have a different set of priorities, and typically it's more of a timbral approach to counterpoint, in that you want to plan your instrumental sections, you want to plan the way instruments work in and out, in such a way that they don't create distortion over the track or build up too much at a certain frequency. This is what mastering is all about, and even intelligent composition for pop music in many ways. So a lot of pop songs these days are very simplistic because it avoids having to really plan out counterpoint for different sections. But you still have groups like, and there's hundreds of these, but a great example is Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum, this avant-garde group from California, who I think they're actually breaking up soon. I think I mentioned that on the podcast before, but they'd actually plan out their compositions with the different sections such that they'd have those spectral holes built in the composition itself so that everything could come out in the recording. Another thing that we've only kind of brought back into the equation recently is actually the rhythmic aspect of counterpoint and consonance and dissonance. This is like within the past 50 years, composers went, wait a second. So we've been dealing with this very traditional approach to rhythm, and then we have total serialism, which has allowed us to discover new approaches to rhythm. Maybe we should be looking into ways that rhythm works with and against the human psyche. So there's actually been there have actually been essays written on what kind of rhythmic structures are more consonant or dissonant, and how we perceive pleasure from them. So all of a sudden, counterpoint has counterpoint, just like the pitch aspect of things, has expanded drastically, and it's still kind of a burgeoning field of activity. I mean, we kind of see it in Brian Ferneyhough's work. We kind of see it in Babbitt's work, and it's definitely here. It's definitely of contention. Another thing to think about with counterpoint is what popular music has done for counterpoint. A lot of what popular artists have been doing with counterpoint, they're obviously, with rare exception, they're usually not conscious of it as being counterpoint. They're more working with instrumental and notes relations as sounds pleasurable to them. But if you look at something like Nine Inch Nails' The Fragile, the counterpoint for that is actually quite fascinating. It's not traditional counterpoint, not in the least, but Trent Reznor has his own approach to counterpoint, and it comes out, it's characteristic of nearly every album he's put out. He has these tendencies that always seem to be contrapuntal in nature, and even harmonic to some degree. But they're still very expressive and effective for his music, and even if though he is kind of breaking the rules of counterpoint, he found a way to do it very expressively and effectively. But an exception to that rule, of course, would be... I'd say Weezer's Pinkerton would be a great exception to that rule. Rivers Cuomo for Pinkerton actually studied music theory at a community college for a couple of years, and... you can hear, like, if you listen to the track Fallen For You, he has this modulation that happens over a guitar solo, and the guitar solo it had to have been notated because it's using 18th century counterpoint, and it's so weird to hear that out of this rock album that's otherwise really noisy and raw. But their harmonic and melodic motions are kind of, I don't want to say predictable, but they're definitely, you know, predicated.
Another thing I just remembered about counterpoint is contrast motion is ideal.
Right.
And then what's stagnant?
Stagnant parallel.
Yeah, stagnant parallel is like, okay. And then, again, parallel motion is very taboo.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's something to think about, though, when you're listening to the next Metallica album. Is Metallica a good example of that?
I don't know. Well, I don't really know.
It's something to think about the next time you're listening to hard rock and you hear a bunch of parallel fifths, because that's typically not what you want to have happen. But they're using parallel fifths in the same way that people in the Renaissance were using parallel fifths. And when you're running music, when you're running audio through that much distortion, using parallel fifths actually brings out tones in the upper levels of the distortion, such that you get both, it helps to bring out the fundamental, but it also helps to brighten the distortion at the top. So it turns out to have a very effective aesthetic purpose, even if it's not following rules which have been socially established or culturally established for hundreds of years.
I couldn't find anything about the Beatles and counterpoint, but I want to say that the, you know, in Eleanor Rigby, the da 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 da, I feel like that was at least an example of reverse counterpoint or something. I can't find any evidence of it, so.
Well, counterpoint is still a very colorful subject, and there's, like, there's a, oh, I forget what it's called, there's table compositions, for example, where one person reads a sheet, piece of, they, you lay a piece of sheet music on the table, and one reads it from the top down, and the other reads it from the bottom up, from the opposite side. And the composition is, it's a palindrome, and it's composed in such a way that it actually works contrapuntally in addition to, it works contrapuntally and notationally. So, I mean, this is the same type of thing that kind of goes into the rounds. Doing stuff like rounds is pretty difficult because you have to be really aware of how your counterpoint is working. Not just in like a traditional aspect, but one of the benefits of actually studying counterpoint, I hate to say it because I hate studying counterpoint. I don't want to make myself out to be a proponent of counterpoint at any cost, but at the same time, I have to admit that its benefits are pretty wide-ranging. If you're doing something like a fugue or a round, and I mean, I don't want to say people should write fugues all the time, because writing a traditional fugue has been done so many times it just shouldn't be done anymore.
You should do it.
Oh, I've done it.
I don't know. I would encourage it. I feel like it, not only do I feel is it give you a good sense of how music kind of developed that way, I think it's really fun. I really liked writing. That was also part of my problems with college, was I liked to write with these rules, and I was forced to break those rules and not use them at all. And then once I did that, and then was given permission to use them again, I just couldn't do it anymore. It was like no longer was it my natural tendency. So even though I really enjoyed it and really have fun with it and create things I really liked, it was no longer what my sound wanted to sound like. So it was a disaster. But I kind of wish I took a counterpoint class, but I took so many other things I didn't have enough credits for, because I never really officially learned counterpoint, but I really liked composing using, you know, counterpoint and the general mentality of the, you know, the classical era. And I always had a really good sense of counterpoint, I felt. You know, it's just nice to write music where you make sure you don't leap, and you kind of know, move. And when you get into a pattern of it, it is just kind of like, it just, everything you do, it just seems like there's an exact location that the music wants to go. And you just keep doing that. And it's just like a formula of music that creates itself, which I always really enjoyed.
It kind of reemphasizes that theory that Bach's composing was really more formulaic than expressive.
Yeah, but I mean, but Bach, I mean,
yeah, if anybody found an expressive way to use something so formulaic, it was definitely him.
Yeah.
That's the difficulty I'm having with counterpoint. It's so formulaic, and yet when you actually know how to use it,
but it's so
perfect.
You can
be really expressive. Yeah,
it's just like, I don't know, it's just like finding the natural order of the music. It's just doing what the music wants to do. And then of course it's, I find it's nice to then start with exactly what it's supposed to do, and then take that and then alter it in several ways. And that's just a simple way to get started. You just kind of...
to liven up your recipe.
You're like, here you go, it's perfect, what should I do to this? And then you just spend, you know, the next however long to just kind of alter it And then maybe fix it a bit more, you know, now take these new notes and fix them the way they want to move and then distort them and just...
Run it through spectral analysis. Pitch shift upwards 30 cents.
Ring modulator.
Turn it into a 55-tone scale composition. You know, the little things.
Add some micropolyphony to it.
But yeah, so... Yeah, so apparently we've come to the conclusion that you actually do need counterpoint, whether you like it or not. Well, I don't think it's so much that you need counterpoint. I think it's more that you should be aware of it. And the most effective way that we've found to make people aware of it is to train them in this old, ancient form of counterpoint, which is still pretty effective, but it's old and ancient.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just comes down to you need to... to know the basic form that something could be in, I guess, theoretically. And then once you know and understand that language, you can do everything that's been done since then.
Or things that haven't been done.
Or things that haven't been done.
Yeah.
Although, really, is there anything that hasn't been done yet?
Yeah. Pretty sure there is.
Okay, that's good to know. Should we talk about other things like chord progression?
Yeah, harmonic progressions might be good.
Well, I mean, popular music, especially 12-bar blues, is a perfect example of breaking one of the rules which was forever set in motion, which is, you know, you can't go to... five and then four,
then one. Yeah,
but now most music we hear does it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard to convince people soon that this.
Not to mention the one to three motion.
Oh,
you wanted to. It used to be you wanted to avoid three at all costs, and then you had a composer like Berlioz who, in his songs, would kind of. Edge toward three and then back, and it would be a very expressive move, but he'd build up to it. Now it's like all over the place.
Yeah, one of the reasons I love Berlioz is because he knew exactly what to do, and he would do it, and then he would just throw in notes randomly. Like, he would just add a major second to a chord or, you know, something like that, and the music he created is one of the sounds that I adore and I just gravitate towards. There's just something about taking the comfortableness of counterpoint and chord progression and all of that, and then just a little bit of chaos in smart places, and you've got brilliant music.
I think part of the theory behind how he came up with what he came up with was that unlike the majority of popular composers of the time, the majority of composers were pianists. Berlioz was a guitarist. So he had a completely different approach to the way notes work, which is actually really interesting.
Yeah.
Which is to say he didn't study like counterpoint and stuff. Right. But, you know.
And of course he helps revolutionize orchestration.
Mm-hmm. But counterpoint really, especially harmonic counterpoint, took a much different different turn, obviously, in the 20th century. With serialism coming up, you had to be aware of the way your lines interacted with each other so you wouldn't be repeating notes too often in a certain way that would take away from the expressive quality of your serial lines. In order to control it further and move away from serialism as a form of pitch control and harmonic control to something that would allow a little more creativity and a little more, harmonic regimentation was pitch class set theory.
Yeah.
So you'd be able to get these interval sets, and you only use them throughout a composition, and you'd end up with these harmonies that all work together in kind of the same way, because they're from the same interval class set or groups of intervals. So it's kind of like when you're playing in a major key, you typically only use these chords. It's the same exact thing, only the composer can choose what that exactly entails. And by sticking to those intervals, you can produce a piece that sounds kind of like itself throughout itself.
Hmm.
Which is a blast. But even discussing the pitch side of counterpoint, interval class sets or pitch class sets became a really interesting approach. By combining pitch class sets and interval class sets, you come up with a new approximation of how counterpoint worked before. Rather than focusing on the correlation between the horizontal aspects of traditional counterpoint, by combining pitch class set and interval class set, you actually come dauntingly close to... You pretty much create a new form of composing with regiment and counterpoint, much like the 18th century counterpoint worked. Actually, it can be more difficult sometimes because you can easily trip yourself up. There's more room for freedom with pitch class set theory, but there's also a little more room for despair.
I wonder how do quarter tones fit in with counterpoint?
Actually, not too difficultly. It's the same thing as when people asked how 12-tone serialism worked with counterpoint. Really, the answer is it's, you know, a 24-note scale is a 12-note scale with 12 more notes.
Yeah.
But then, it just takes a different approach.
But
then again, if you talk to, like, you can read these, if you've ever read a discussion between Terry Riley and Lamont Young, about their experiments with equal temperament, they would tell you that they actually had a very specific version of harmonic and melodic counterpoint because the notes sound different and they lead in different directions. They have different expressive qualities. And if you're not aware of how these qualities kind of manifest musically, you could be creating a composition that really isn't that pleasant. Part of the reason we have the counterpoint we have, the counterpoint we study is steeped in well temperament. So if once you go outside of that temperament, whether it's through microtonality or just a different tuned scale, you encounter a whole slew of new problems because of the way those individual notes, the way their harmonics and overtones align and misalign and move in and out of phase. So counterpoint. Love it, hate it, it's here to stay, and there's nothing we can do about it.
So learn it.
So, you know, stick that pencil in your teeth, stick that gauze between your teeth to keep your clenching down and just buckle down and draw some dots and lines.
Learn it so you know how to break it.
And when to break it, and why you hate it. Because a how and what isn't good without a why. Never mind. That made no sense.
This is Dave Blogdoven Bowers.
And this is Ryan Denardis.
Signing off.